As the Armada de Malacca approached the sandy, palm-shaded shores of Cebu, the crew members could see that the island was home to the most prosperous people they had encountered so far on the voyage. They watched village after village emerge as if by magic from the obscurity of the jungle. The inhabitants looked placid and well-fed and not particularly startled by strange ships. Their huts, rising on stilts in groups of five or six, resembled homesteads or even small estates. Overhead, tall palm trees blotted out the sky and cast wide swaths of shade. Extending from the water's edge, fishing lines crisscrossed the shallow water, and a little farther from land, speedy proas traveled out to greet the arriving fleet. No longer did the men of the Armada have to contend with nomadic giants or wandering tribes living at the end of the world. Here was civilization, or at least a semblance thereof. Once the ships dropped anchor, Magellan dispatched his illegitimate son, Cristóbal Rabello, as ambassador to the King of Cebu, along with the slave Enrique, to serve as an interpreter. Arriving on land, said Pigafetta, Rabello and Enrique found a vast crowd of people together with the king. The local chieftain asked what he could do for them. Enrique stepped forward again and announced that his captain owed allegiance, he said, to the greatest king and prince in the world, and that he was going to discover the Moluccas. His captain had decided to pass this way because of the good report which he had of him from the king of Limasawa and to buy food. Impressed, the king welcomed the visitors, but he advised it was their custom for all ships that entered their ports to pay tribute. Magellan refused to pay anyone. He saw the local populace as prey, as helpers, and as heathen, not as equals, and he intended to claim their territory for Spain and their souls for the church. Negotiations between Magellan and the King of Cebu broke down when Magellan, through Enrique, insisted that his king was the greatest in all the world, and the Armada de Malacca would never pay tribute to a lesser ruler. The king shrewdly replied that he would confer with his chieftains and return the next day. As a sign of his peaceful intentions, he offered the landing party, according to Pigafetta, refreshments of many dishes, all made from meat and contained in porcelain platters, besides many jars of wine, and sent them happily stumbling back to their waiting ships, where they told Magellan the details of the exchange. Despite his belligerent words, Magellan possessed one diplomatic asset, the King of Limasawa, who had come along on this leg of the journey, and was pleased to, in Pigafetta's words, speak to the king of the great courtesy of our captain general. The local king's soothing words had the desired effect, and on Monday morning, the Armada's notary, accompanied by Enrique, held a formal meeting with the king of Cebu, Raja, or King Humabon. This time, Humabon offered to pay tribute to the most powerful king in the world rather than demanding it for himself. The impasse was broken. Magellan acknowledged Humabon's generous offer and announced he would, in Pigafetta's words, trade with him and no others. Almost despite himself, Magellan had found a home in Cebu. The next day, Tuesday, Magellan had more good news. The Limasawan king announced that Humabon was preparing a great feast to send to the ships, and, in Pigafetta's words, after dinner he would send two of his nephews with other notable men to make peace with him. After gratefully receiving the food, Magellan decided to make another show of force and trotted out an armor-clad seaman whose demonstration of European-style combat predictably alarmed the Cebuan emissary. Once again, Magellan turned the situation to his advantage. Pigafetta wrote, "The captain general told him not to be frightened, for our arms were soft towards our friends and harsh toward our enemies, and as handkerchiefs wipe off sweat, so did our arms overthrow and destroy all our adversaries and the enemies of our faith." The lesson had its intended effect. Once Magellan had alternately impressed and intimidated the Cebuans, relations between the two proceeded like a tale in a storybook. The king's nephew came aboard Trinidad, accompanied by a retinue of eight chieftains, to swear loyalty. Holding court, Magellan played the part of a magnanimous potentate with gusto. Pigafetta remembered, "The captain general was seated in a red velvet chair, the principal men of the ships on leather chairs, and the others on mats upon the floor. The captain general asked them through an interpreter whether that prince had the authority to make peace. Pigafetta continued. The Captain General said many things concerning peace, and that he prayed to God to confirm it in heaven. They said they had never heard such words, but that they took great pleasure in hearing them. The Captain General, seeing that they listened and answered willingly, began to advance arguments to induce them to accept the faith. Rising from his special chair, Magellan abruptly changed the subject, wanting to know who would succeed the king after his death. Pigafetta wrote, "They replied that the king had no son but many daughters, and that this prince, who was his nephew, had as wife the king's eldest daughter, and for love of her he was called prince. And they said, moreover, that when the father and the mother were old, no more account was taken of them, but the children commanded them." This state of affairs struck Magellan as contradictory to the commandments, and he proceeded to explain some basic tenets of the Bible. His oratory must have been highly persuasive, because, said Pigafetta, all joyfully entreated the Captain General to leave them two men, or at least one, to instruct them in the faith. Magellan explained that he could not leave anyone behind with them, but if they wished, the Armada's priest, Father Valderrama, would gladly baptize the Cebuans, and when they returned they would bring priests and friars to instruct them. Pigafetta reported that the chieftains, Magellan, and the onlookers all became so excited by the prospect that everyone wept with joy. Before he began in earnest, Magellan cautioned the Cebuans not to convert to Christianity simply to win his favor, and promised not to, in Pigafetta's words, cause any displeasure to those who wished to live according to their own law. But, he said, the Christians would get preferential treatment. Pigafetta recorded, "All cried out with one voice that they were not becoming Christians through fear or to please us, but of their own free will." Magellan was so encouraged by this response that he promised to leave behind a suit of armor, just one, in gratitude. It was time for another feast. Once again, Magellan was the fortunate recipient of island hospitality, in the form of rice, swine, goats, and fowls, as Pigafetta wrote, all given with profuse apologies for their inadequacy. In return, Magellan conferred a bolt of white linen, a red cap, strings of glass beads, and a gilded glass cup on the prince. There was more. Magellan asked Pigafetta to give Humabon a yellow and violet silk robe, made in Turkish style, a fine red cap, some strings of glass beads, all in a silver dish, and two gilt drinking cups. By the time the feast ended, the Cebuans regarded Magellan as something more than a man. He was a powerful and beneficent god. The adulation rubbed off on the volatile Captain General, who increasingly believed himself to be divinely inspired, his expedition a manifestation of God's will. It was a dangerous delusion. When Magellan finally left Trinidad to make his triumphal entry into Cebu, the occasion proved every bit as majestic as he could have wished. A delegation from the ships, including an excited Pigafetta, landed on Cebu to greet Humabon, dressed in regal splendor. Pigafetta wrote, "Having duly made reverence to him, the interpreter told the king that his master thanked him very warmly for his present, and that he sent this present not in return for his present, but for the intrinsic love which he bore him. We dressed him in the robe, placed the cap on his head, and gave him the other things. Then, kissing the beads and putting them on his head, I presented them to him. He, doing the same, accepted them." Impressive as they were, these exchanges were a mere prelude. The excitement began when the prince escorted Pigafetta and several others to his raised hut. They climbed ladders and within found four young girls playing musical instruments. The Europeans noticed more than musical ability. The girls were bare-breasted and extremely alluring. Said Pigafetta, "The prince had the quite naked girls dance for us." Reluctant to contradict Magellan's prohibition against intercourse with native women until they converted to Christianity, Pigafetta refrained from describing the frolicking and lovemaking with the female musicians, but he leaves no doubt about the evening's outcome. All around them, similar celebrations of European Cebuan amity involving ordinary villagers and sailors were taking place that night. The one question is whether Magellan himself participated, but, given his restraint and self-denial throughout the voyage, it is unlikely that he yielded to the temptations of the flesh, even on this occasion.